You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we hear from a retired Wisconsin pastor who started turning donated firearms into garden tools. Now, when you're walking around outside or on a hike, how often do you think about what's under your feet? For our next guest, the answer is all the time. They say underneath the dirt and pavement, Wisconsin's landscape is made up of some really interesting things that tell a story about how much the land we now call Wisconsin has changed over hundreds of millions of years. Lindsay Summers and Benji Johnson are students at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. They took a physical rock kit from their lab and turned it into an interactive online guide to some of the state's rocks and minerals for the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey. I talked to them about the guide and other cool rock stuff on Friday. Benji, let's start with you. Can you tell us where this idea for an interactive online rock and mineral guide came from?
Well, the idea came from the survey because we had this box of rocks, been sitting around for a while, and it's full of rocks that are important to Wisconsin. But we wanted to make it more publicly accessible because, especially since COVID, you know, we can't take these rock kits around to the schools as much. So we wanted to make an online tool to really introduce anybody to the rocks that make Wisconsin as cool as it is. So we made the story map. There's maps, there's pictures, there's lots of fun facts. It's good for any age of individual, you know, teachers, children, grandma and grandpa, up north, anything. It's for you. So we just wanted to make a really accessible online tool.
I want to meet some of the rocks and minerals in the guide. Lindsay, can you start us off with dolomite, what it is and how it got there?
Yeah, so dolomite, it's a sedimentary rock, but it forms from limestone, which is another kind of rock. But it forms because of the skeletal materials of sea creatures, which doesn't really sound right for the Midwest. But it's because of shallow seas that covered most of the U.S. about 400 to 500 million years ago, which I think is super interesting. But yeah, that's why dolomite is here in Wisconsin.
So Wisconsin spent a fair amount of prehistory, Lindsay, underwater?
Yeah, some of it.
Benji, let's go to calcite now. And I understand a part of our economy has an interest or has had an interest in that.
That's exactly right. Actually, the reason why Wisconsin is known as the Badger State is because in the 19th century in southwest Wisconsin, when lead mining and zinc mining were really big, the miners dug holes into the sides of the hillsides and they were known as badgers. But most importantly, calcite is often found with zinc and lead. And that deposit is known as the Upper Mississippi Valley deposit, and that is very characteristic to our region and our state's history.
Lindsay, you included fossils in the guide. Why did they show up there?
So they're pretty easy to find along the shores of Lake Michigan, so we thought it'd be a cool thing to put them in the guide so that people can look at the guide and then go out and find their own fossils. A lot of them look a lot like current sea creatures or seashells and stuff like that, but you can identify them by looking at rocks like dolomite, like I said before, or limestone, or other sedimentary rocks like that.
And I understand, Lindsay, you have a childhood history of looking for fossils.
I do. I live in a town that is on Lake Michigan, so when I was little, I used to go to the beach for like hours and just look for cool rocks and fossils and stuff, and now I'm a geology major, so you never know where it's going to go.
Let's check out one more of our foundation minerals and rocks here. Benji, chert has an interesting story.
Chert does have an interesting story. Actually, if you've ever found an arrowhead outside, it's probably made out of chert. So chert is one of those really hard materials that is still great for tool making, but because of the fact it was used for spears and things like that, has a long human history in Wisconsin and in many other places. So chert is really cool. Flint is also a variety of chert, so that's important for fire making, as many people know.
Talking to Benji Johnson and Lindsay Summers, they put together an online interactive guide to some of the state's rocks and minerals for the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey. Lindsay, there are some pictures in the guide of field work that you've done. Can you tell us what it's like going out and hunting for the samples you're looking for?
Yeah, so it actually wasn't too hard for us to find a lot of the rocks and minerals because a lot of them are found in some of the same environments. So we went to Port Washington on the shores of Lake Michigan, and we looked for a few of them, and we thought this would be great because other people can look at the guide, see what the rocks look like, and then identify them themselves. And we thought it'd be great to get some of the rocks in their natural environment, which is really accessible to everyone.
Benji, glacier is a huge part of Wisconsin's geological story. Can you tell us about the role of glaciers in shaping our landscape?
Yeah, many people know. I mean, we take great pride in Wisconsin for having such an active glacial past. I mean, the Ice Age Trail traverses the edge of the last ice sheet that cut across our landscape. But glaciers are important for many reasons. They deposited gravel that form the foundation for many of our aquifers. They've done a lot to deposit good soils for farming even. So glaciers are very important. And I hope that people continue to take pride in our glacial history.
Lindsay, this is stuff that happened on a massive time scale. Hard for me, I'll say, to wrap my head around. What's it like for you to have this, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, even million year view of the landscape we might take for granted?
So it really is hard to conceptualize for anyone. I am a geology major and I still struggle to really think about it a lot. But I think it's important to consider how long it takes, like millions, even billions of years for these rocks and minerals to form. And when we look around us and we look at these rocks, I think it's really cool and important to keep that in mind.
And Benji,
you really get such an appreciation also because even things like the dolomite that Lindsay was talking about earlier that was laid down by those shallow seas, that undercuts all of the central Great Lakes. And that same layer of rock is actually what Niagara Falls flows over today. So it just gives you a better appreciation for the history of the land that you live on today. I think it's pretty cool.
That's a great place to leave it. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
That was Benji Johnson and Lindsay Summers, two UW-Madison students who put together an interactive online guide to Wisconsin's rocks and minerals for the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey. You can check that guide out for yourself right now at wpr.org/centraltime. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary-Kate McCoy with a story about the history of the Culver's fast food franchise.
We recently received a question to the Wisconsin Project wondering about the origins of the Culver's franchise. While the popular fast food chain feels almost synonymous with Wisconsin now, that wasn't always the case. WPR's Alyssa Alamand recently sat down with Craig Culver to learn more about the Culver's story.
I love this place. Why would you want to live anywhere else? By the way, folks, I'm looking out over the Wisconsin River, the bluffs across the way.
Just about everyone in Wisconsin is familiar with Culver's. Whether it's the cheese curds, the custard, or the butter burgers that draw you in, its popularity has extended beyond its home state to the greater Midwest and even southern states like Texas and Florida. But have you ever wondered how the food chain came to be?
Sauk Prairie is home to me, home to the Culver family, home to Culver's as well.
Sauk Prairie includes the towns of Prairie du Sac and Sauk City, with a population of about 8,000 people total. The two towns collide on Water Street, just down the road from the current Culver's company office, which was built in Prairie du Sac in 2009. 25 years earlier, the first Culver's restaurant opened in Sauk City.
You know, Culver's restaurant wasn't the first business that we've had here. The first business was an A&W drive-in that my parents had that they started in 1961.
The Culver family sold the A&W and moved on to owning two other restaurants in the area, one of which was a supper club, which is where Craig drew inspiration for the Butterburger. The family bought and sold the A&W another time some years later, eventually coming back to the A&W and converting it into what is now the first Culver's location.
That was in 1984, March of 1984, and July 18th, 1984, we opened as Culver's. And as the story goes, we just about didn't make it through that first year.
The restaurant was located right across from a Hardee's, which Craig said was the fastest growing burger chain in the U.S. at that time. And the Dairy Queen Blizzard was invented in 1985. But of course, Culver's made it through. The first successful franchise location is in Baraboo, which opened in 1990. Craig said growth picked up after that, with the company now operating more than 830 restaurants in 25 states. 142 of those locations are in Wisconsin.
That's our mission at Culver's. It's not to see how many restaurants we can have someday. My mission, our mission, is how many good restaurants we can have. And it takes great people to make that happen.
Rita Larson was an administrative assistant in accounting for Culver's for 22 years. She retired in October. All three of her sons worked at Culver's throughout high school and college, and her oldest son actually became general manager of the Sauk, Spring Green, and Baraboo restaurants.
It's just always been a family atmosphere where all the team members care about not only what you're going through at work, but even your personal life.
In 2020, the franchise opened a record 50 new locations. Craig says there's a plan in place to open another 300 restaurants down the line, which would put the company at 1,000 locations. Craig will always be proud of his roots.
You know, for me, I grew up here. I love my hometown, and I think that's true with a lot of people. Some people, I guess, want to get away from where they grew up. That was never the case with me. I'm very proud to be from here. I'm very proud to grow the business here that we have.
WPR's Alyssa Alamand brought us that story about the history of Culver's. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, we'll find out how a retired Wisconsin pastor is making gardening tools out of firearms. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. A retired Wisconsin pastor says he's tired of gun violence in the United States and wants to do something to draw attention to it. So he uses a forge and blacksmith skills to repurpose donated guns into garden tools. Jeff Wild joins us now. He spent 34 years as a pastor in Madison, Janesville, and Racine, and now puts on blacksmithing demonstrations as part of this project. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's an honor.
How did this idea first get started for you?
The idea first got started when I read an article in an issue of the Christian Century several years ago, written by two pastors who had just published a book. The people are Shane Claiborne, a pastor in Pennsylvania, and Michael Martin, a Mennonite pastor in Colorado. And they, you know, the article was really a summary of their book. And after I read the article, I was interested enough to order the book, Beating Guns: Hope for People Who Are Weary of Violence. And I read the book and really resonated with what they were doing and the theology behind it, their biblical awareness and a summary of the gun situation in our country. And because of my background and interest, I realized I could do this in Wisconsin and decided to pursue that interest by purchasing a forge and other blacksmithing equipment, and then taking some classes over the past few years to try to equip myself to become a blacksmith. And so I reached out to people I knew who might have guns and was fortunate to be gifted a number of them and began to work with them.
Can you talk about the symbolism behind beating not swords, but firearms in this case into plowshares?
Yeah. Just to underscore the idea of beating swords into plows and spears into pruning hooks is a biblical reference from the early chapters of the book of Isaiah, which is a prophet, where he talks about the new age to come. And so the symbolic meaning to me is much the same as it was then. It is the announcement of a time of a peaceable kingdom, a peaceable world that people and God's people and humanity are able to participate in. And for me personally, I'm forever marvel at the difference of when I start with a gun in my hands and how that feels to me. And when I complete the process and hold a garden tool in my hands. And I have a love for gardening and a commitment to it. It gives me great joy. So to fashion an instrument that could cause violence and into a garden tool that produces food for people, myself, my family, as well as other people, is a very meaningful endeavor.
On a just solely practical level, could you talk about what are some of the biggest challenges in taking a firearm of some sort and turning it into a tool for gardening?
Oh, that's a good question. It takes time and a lot of thoughtfulness and planning and then energy. And so if I were to work with a long arm, say a 22 rifle, I can disassemble it. And there's a couple ways you can do it. One is to cut the barrel right up the middle and use the barrel and out of one, I've made two garden trowels. If you cut the barrel up the middle and bend it, you have a very nice looking garden trowel. The other one, I split the first inches that I could use as a digging tool and weeding tool because the barrel was thicker. The challenge of working with firearms from what I gather is working with a piece of steel that's hollow in the middle. I think it increases the risk of injury because the heat travels up the barrel, and when you put it in a bucket of water to cool it down, the steam really blows out the top of the barrel. And it's hard working with that hole in the middle because of the heat variations between the steel, what's inside and what's outside.
Now, I could see a gun owner saying, well, hang on, I don't think of my firearm as a tool of violence. I might use it for target shooting or for sustenance via hunting or view it as an instrument of defending myself or my family or my community. What would you say to them about your project of converting firearms to tools?
Well, that's a big question. What comes to my mind is originally, before firearms were being mass produced, Eli Whitney, by the way, gets credit for beginning to be able to produce guns rapidly, mass production, because he was a great inventor of machines to build them. Before, at that time, a firearm was a tool generally used in rural communities on farms for practical reasons. I think you could describe a firearm in a number of ways now, as you have done for shooting clay pigeons, which I have done, for hunting pheasants, which I did in college as a student in Iowa, or for deer hunting, which I did as a growing up in Beaver Dam with my friends, who all went through hunter safety, taught by members of the National Rifle Association. But we also know that the firearms cause, right this year, is 40,000 deaths. And so in that case, it's fair to say that those firearms are instruments of violence. So that's how I would respond to that question, and then say, what do you say to that?
And now you do public demonstrations. You don't just close yourself up in a shop and convert firearms into tools. What do people see, and what do you talk to them about as you're doing your craft?
No, that's an interesting question. I decided to go public with my demonstrations after hearing about the verdict of Kyle Rittenhouse, because I've immersed myself in learning about gun violence, and I immersed myself in learning how to become a blacksmith. And so deciding to go public, I wanted to provide those demonstrations. And by demonstration is a twofold meaning. One is kind of a show and tell. And the second is protesting firearm violence. In terms of the response of the people who have participated in those demonstrations, I'm told that they're powerful. For instance, I'm not on Facebook, but my wife is. One person responded to the articles that have recently come out in the news by saying the visual's good. You know, it's pretty fascinating to watch someone forge a garden tool out of a firearm, but the narrative that went with it, as he described it, was even more impressive. So I was very happy to hear that. And the other feedback I've received has been quite positive.
Jeff, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing your project with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Jeff Wild is a retired Wisconsin pastor who started forging guns into gardening tools. He was with us today to talk about his blacksmithing project and what it means. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, COVID-19 has been a big topic in the media for 2 years now. How did big news outlets handle it? A media writer looks at COVID coverage, and you can join the conversation. Plus, author Ann Patchett is with us for a new book of essays called These Precious Days. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the January 6th Commission is reviewing new documents turned over by a former White House official. We'll check in on the latest findings and what it all means for the ongoing investigation. First, the last in a series of federal moratoriums on evictions expired at the end of July this year, raising concerns about a possible wave of evictions. We're a few months out from that now. Numbers did not go up dramatically compared to pre-pandemic numbers, but there are still concerns for renters here in the state. We wanted to check back in on the situation going into winter, especially some of the legal aspects of eviction and other situations that could still lead to someone becoming homeless. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you someone who's been affected by this story? Did you benefit from an eviction moratorium or from renters' assistance along the way? Were you able to stay in your home? Ultimately, if you're a property owner, someone who leases apartments or homes, what has this all looked like from your perspective? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kristen Slonsky is an attorney and advocacy and legal services director for the Wausau-based Wisconsin Judicare. Kristen, welcome back to Central Time. Make sure we have her. Mitch is an attorney and clinical professor and director of the Economic Justice Institute and Neighborhood Law Clinic at the UW Law School. Mitch, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Mitch, let's start with you. I understand a new eviction defense clinic just opened up at UW. Is that timing related in part to the end of these moratoriums?
You know, the new eviction defense clinic the University of Wisconsin Law School was able to open up is actually, it's related to the pandemic relief that was ordered last year at the end of 2020. So as part of the CARES Act way, way back, you know, it allotted a lot of money to the various different states, and it finally worked its way down to the city of Madison, which allocated money out to a number of legal services organizations, and the university was one of them. So it's an example of how it takes a long time for the stuff that you hear at the top of the hour in the news stories about the federal government allocating money. It takes a while for it to get down to the local level.
And I think we have Kristen. Kristen, I mentioned a wave of evictions, a feared wave of evictions. What have we seen now since the last moratorium expired?
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me. So we at Wisconsin Judicare, we deal with the counties in the northern half of the state, the northern 33 counties. And at least from what we've seen coming into our offices, we have not seen the wave of evictions based on failure to pay rent that we were concerned about, but we are still getting calls from people who are facing homelessness for other reasons unrelated to non-payment of rent.
What kind of reasons are driving that? I know we've got higher housing costs in Wisconsin, for one thing. What are some of the reasons leading to homelessness among the people who are calling your office?
Well, with the caveat that this is all anecdotal evidence, we only hear from the people who call us. We are seeing more people who are coming to us and they're just simply having their tenancies not renewed. So if you're a month-to-month tenant in general, you can be non-renewed on 28 days notice or one full rental period from your landlord. And if you're an annual tenant on a written lease, usually a one-year written lease, then at the expiration of that one-year period, you can be non-renewed and the landlord doesn't generally have to give any reason at all for that. And we're seeing a lot more people than we used to see who are coming to us not knowing why they were non-renewed or suspecting that they were non-renewed because their relationship with their landlord soured over the course of the moratorium, maybe when they weren't paying rent but couldn't be evicted for it.
And Mitch, what are you hearing in the Madison area and statewide when it comes to kind of what happened after the eviction moratorium came to an end?
Well, we have seen and we have heard of people filing evictions right away. And, you know, as soon as the moratorium ended, people were interested in filing evictions, even though there was and still is money available to pay for folks who have not been able to pay rent. Evictions have still been filed. So that's kind of a tragedy unto itself that people are getting evictions filed against them, even though there's money available to cover for what they weren't able to pay.
Kristen, what have you seen when it comes to the role of that that rental relief funding that Mitch was talking about, which we've heard in different parts of the state is out there but can be slow to arrive?
Right. So there's a few problems with the Wisconsin Emergency Rental Assistance funds getting out the door. One is that the tenant has to do their part, and that requires some paperwork. And there are some low-income tenants for whom that's a real barrier. The other is that they do have to have the landlord has to work with them. They have to give some information to the agency, usually the CAP agencies that are giving out the funds. And so if either of those two things fall through, then the application is incomplete and the funds don't flow. The other is that the landlord has to accept those funds. And usually that comes with an agreement that they won't bring an eviction action for failure to pay rent for those months that they're getting paid for. But then we get back to this whole idea of like, once those months are paid, you can't be evicted for non-payment of those months of rent arrears. But if you fall behind again, or if your landlord just has decided they're done with you and they don't want to renew your tenancy, they can give you a 28-day notice if you're a month-to-month tenant and you really have no recourse. Your rent arrears has been paid, but you can still be non-renewed and evicted if you stay beyond the time of the tenancy terminating.
We're looking at evictions and the risk of homelessness facing renters in Wisconsin after federal eviction moratoriums came to an end. We have Kristen Slonsky with us with the Wausau-based Wisconsin Judicare, and Mitch with us from the UW Law School, director of the Economic Justice Institute and Neighborhood Law Clinic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have experience with this from any part of the story, if you've faced eviction, if you had trouble paying your rent during the pandemic, received this emergency relief, if you rent to people, what kind of things are you seeing? What kind of challenges did you face? Call in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Bill is with us in Madison. Bill, hello. Bill, are you there?
Yes.
There you are. Hi. What did you want to tell us about, Bill?
Well, I'm a small property owner. I have an 8-unit and some duplexes, and I use a property management service. And we have tried to work with people that fell behind. and we filled out everything properly, went through all the hoops, which they make you jump through a lot of hoops, and then they switch it out on you, and the money just wouldn't come. And even though the money is there, they don't have the people, the government, it doesn't have the people that really are working hard enough to get the money to these people to make it happen. The system's broken. And even though money's available, there are so many people that are getting evicted because the system's failing them. And I'm one of them. I've seen it happen. I mean, I got somebody behind over $4,000-some, and we've been trying to get the money. And pretty soon, he's going to have to go. You know, and everything's been filled out properly. Everything. It's just it's a very poor execution. So, and I just wanted to make that point.
Bill, thanks a lot for sharing that story. Mitch, you were saying the money is slow to come. Bill says it's really slow to come. He's trying to help work with his renters, and they're just not seeing it happen.
Yeah, you know what this raises is the really important question of what can we learn from the federal government allocating billions of dollars and the state chipping in millions more. And the process taking a long time. It isn't simply, well, government, and let's throw up our hands and be, you know, upset about it. People like Bill don't want to evict people. People obviously don't want to be evicted. The people who are trying to get the aid into people's hands want to do that. But the process is so slow that Bill just called it broken. So how do we make a more robust system that's able to spring up the next time that we have a health crisis like this?
Kristen, what kind of advice would you have for someone in our caller's position and that renter he mentioned falling behind on bills as they wait for this rental relief? Is there any kind of recourse out there for them?
Well, it depends. If what you're talking about is legal recourse, unfortunately, no, I can't think of any. You have to go through the agency that's distributing the WERA funds. And here in Wisconsin, there's more than 15 of those agencies. So the first thing that I would advise someone to do is check and make sure that they're applying with the correct agency for their area. And you can find information for that at wiscap.org or Wisconsin Energy Assistance is also helping people process their applications, and they'll take the application over the phone. We send a lot of our clients there, especially our clients who have some literacy barriers or maybe language barriers. That can be helpful to have someone walk you through it over the phone rather than try to figure it out for your own online. But, you know, like I said before, there are some, it's paperwork, and for a lot of low-income tenants, paperwork can really present a barrier, whether it's because English isn't their first language, or they have some literacy problems, or maybe, it's just difficult for them to process the written word. These are real problems, and I'm not seeing a whole lot of solutions that are being offered, even from the people who are trying to help.
We're talking to attorneys Kristen Slonsky from Wisconsin Judicare and Mitch, a clinical professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School. We're looking at evictions after a federal moratorium ended earlier this year and the challenges facing renters and those who rent to them. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you rent your housing. What have the last few months looked like for you? How's your relationship with the person you rent from? Have you been at risk of eviction in the last year and a half or so? If you rent to people, are you seeing these problems as our first caller did? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk about evictions with Kristen Slonsky, Advocacy and Legal Services Director for Wisconsin Judicare, and Mitch, Clinical Professor and Director of the Economic Justice Institute and Neighborhood Law Clinic at the UW Law School. You can join in with your questions, your own experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Michael joins us next in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. I guess kind of what I wanted to share, I've been renting in one form or another for the better part of 13 years or so. And at different times, I've managed to be pretty secure in housing during the pandemic, sort of counterintuitively. But anyway, all that is to say, there have been times where I've been less than secure in my ability to pay rent, have had or other bills like electricity, have had to use various forms of assistance. But really, my point is that both with the current eviction protections, with existing rental assistance programs, and ones that are a direct response to COVID, what gets me is they address a symptom of the problem, but they're not really addressing the root cause. So, I mean, landlords can choose not to renew and jack up the rent on a unit by $300-$500 because housing prices have gone up in an area, stuff like that, not having enough affordable housing for people, and people being forced to rent month to month to month for years and years and years, and buying, you know, multiple homes for their landlords while they're not approved for a house loan.
Michael, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. Kristen, Michael's saying a fundamental problem, not enough housing that people can afford, and that's ultimately driving up the costs of housing, rental and otherwise.
Yeah, Rob, I think Michael's exactly right. You know, this is just a broken market where there's far more demand than there is supply for low-income housing. And, you know, some of the supply that is out there is being taken off of the market. We had a pretty hot housing market this last summer, and we saw a number of mom-and-pop landlords get out of the business, sell, both because they had now gone a year or more without rent because of the moratorium, or just because the deals were too good to pass up. So it's unfortunately, yeah, I think that Michael is right that we're in the middle of a broken market, and that's underlying a lot of the problems that we're seeing.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Jean in Rock County. Jean, hi.
Hi. I am a 62-year-old woman. My daughter passed away, and I'm raising her two children. I've lived in my same apartment complex for 5 years and have now been given a non-renewal, a 30-day notice, with two kids at Christmas. I've applied for 7 different apartments. By the time you get through all the crazy paperwork, and I mean crazy paperwork, the apartment's already been rented with 18 to 20 people looking at every apartment. So I don't know what the answer is other than being homeless at Christmas with two kids through no fault of my own.
Jean, I'm so sorry to hear that. I hope things work out for you and that they do that soon. I want to throw that, first of all, to Kristen. Kristen, you mentioned that not eviction, but non-renewal. In this case, Jean says with 30 days notice. Is there any legal recourse to challenge that the way one might challenge an eviction? I'm guessing maybe not.
Well, you know that I'm an attorney, so the answer is always it depends.
Sure.
But in general, if we're talking about someone who's either at the end of a term tenancy or on a month-to-month, which a lot of folks in our service area are on month-to-month for years at a time, then in general, the landlord does not have to give any reason for their decision to non-renew. They just have to deliver it properly, and they have to deliver it in a timely manner. So it has to be given at least 28 days before the end of the rental period. It has to be one full rental period. For example, I couldn't give a 28-day notice and try to terminate someone's tenancy in the middle of January. It would have to go through the end of January. But if they comply with those two things, then they've usually complied with the law. There's very few legal defenses to a simple non-renewal. unless it's done in retaliation for the tenant having taken some action that they're protected to take under law, like calling a housing inspector to come out and inspect the home or something like that.
So, Kristen, when somebody in Gene's situation calls your organization, do you have any advice for them on if they can't challenge their non-renewal, finding a new place?
Well, of course, first we look and make sure that they don't have any legal defenses. But if, as is often the case, they don't have a legal defense, then we switch to negotiation. We call the landlord and just simply ask if they would be willing to extend the tenancy for a number, whatever amount of time we can get. Because, you know, as our last two callers have pointed out, it's really difficult to find substitute housing. And if you don't find it, then, you know, as our last caller said, what do? You're homeless at Christmas with two kids? Most landlords are willing to work with us, at least to give a little extra time, as long as they know that the tenant is working in good faith to find alternative housing.
Thanks again for sharing your story, Jean, and best to you. Mitch, how about the situation where somebody is being evicted? What kind of legal alternatives do they have in that case?
Well, you know, with respect to this type of a non-renewal situation, as Kristen mentioned, a reason doesn't need to be given. And I want to stop right there and say that is one of the problems. That is something that the legislature could easily fix. They could pass a law that says if you're going to non-renew somebody, effectively ending their housing, the place that they've called home, they're going to have to leave. You should tell them why. You should at least give them the dignity and say, hey, maybe it's because of a behavior issue that you can correct or improve upon. Maybe it's because the owner wants to do remodeling or needs to do repairs. Maybe it's purely profit taking and they're going to raise the rent a whole lot. But whatever it is, that information is key to a free market. As a rental property owner, you want a bigger market, right? You actually do want more and more renters to be available. And if people are being non-renewed and they come apply, they're one of these 18 to 20 people applying, and I see, oh, they were just non-renewed, the assumption is that there was something negative that they did. And that's an unfair assumption. So on both sides, the renter is disadvantaged, other owners are disadvantaged. That's as Kristen said, a broken system, because a market system is based upon full information. So because we don't require that information to be given, people make really sort of mistaken and misplaced assumptions, and no one can make corrections. So that's an area that I think we could focus on. We could fix that with a pretty simple requirement that people tell people why they're being non-renewed. Then we figure out what those problems are. We can address those problems.
That's all the time we have. Mitch, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Kristen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Rob.
Kristen Slonsky is an advocacy and legal services director with the Wausau-based Wisconsin Judicare. Mitch is an attorney, clinical professor, and director of the Economic Justice Institute and Neighborhood Law Clinic at the UW Law School. They joined us today for a look at evictions in Wisconsin and non-renewals of leases after the moratorium on evictions ended over the summer. Still time for you to share your story, your thoughts as a renter or a property owner who rents residential apartments. Let us know what you've seen out there. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up after the news, we check in on the January 6th investigation in the U.S. House and what new documents obtained by the House committee say about the lead up to the Capitol attack. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.